You are listening to Bible Direction for Life, the sermon podcast of Westside Baptist Church in Bremerton, Washington. We pray that the preaching and teaching you hear on this podcast connects the truth of the Bible to your life, that you would learn more about the triune God who made you and what he made you for. This week, Pastor Peter gets back into his teaching series through the book of Exodus called Patterns of Redemption. Having finished dealing with the first nine blows against Pharaoh, we now turn to the last one, the death of the firstborn, and to the institution of the Passover.
So we were in the book of Exodus a few months back in the spring, and then we took a break for the summer, and we've had a few different things, and then we have some other things coming up in the next few months. We do a number of different things on Sunday night, and we had a baby, and so Pastor John was teaching, and lots of other things going on, but we have 2 weeks to get a little bit of progress in Exodus, and then we have some other things in the rest of November and December, and then in January we'll be doing something else, and then we'll come back to Exodus in February. So we have just a little snippet to make a little bit of progress in Exodus, and then we will be coming back in a couple of months, and we'll be doing Exodus for a few months. But this little snippet, we left off, when we left off in Exodus, we left off at the end of chapter 10, and we'll be talking about the structure of Exodus, but the book of Exodus basically divides into two portions, from chapter 1 to the end of chapter 13, and then from 14 to the end of chapter 40. And so in these 2 weeks, we should actually be able to finish the first half of the book, so it's a good sort of section that we should be able to cover 11, 12, and 13. And so the overall dynamic of the book of Exodus is the movement from the forced building of storehouses, which in Hebrew is mishkanot, for Pharaoh in Egypt, to the willing service of constructing the tabernacle, which is a mishkan for God at the foot of Mount Sinai. So they're building mishkanot in Egypt, and they are going to come and they're going to be engaged in a different building project, a mishkan at the foot of Mount Sinai. So the problem with Egyptian slavery wasn't that Israel was forced to work. We were created for work. We were created for service. The problem is that they were working on the wrong project and for the wrong master. Israel was God's son. They were not supposed to be Pharaoh's slaves. God's son was supposed to serve God and represent God, not serve Pharaoh. And so in the first panel of the book, the first half of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered from service to Pharaoh, and in the second panel of the book, we learn how Israel was delivered for service to the Lord. The central theme of the book of Exodus is in many ways a tale of two building projects, a tale that contrasts the rebellious human desire to build the city and Tower of Babel with the covenantal promise to restore the Gold Garden Sanctuary. And the overall structure of Exodus is in many ways very similar to the structure of Genesis. So Genesis begins with a prologue, and then you have one panel that deals with the one panel that goes up to the call of Abraham, and there's five sections in that first panel. And then you have a second, longer panel of five sections as well. So that's the way Genesis is structured. And while the structural markers of the generation's headings, they're clearer in Genesis than they are in Exodus, once you know what you're looking for, you see that the same basic pattern is there. And so in the handout, I've given you the overview of the structure of Exodus. You have a prologue in the first seven verses. And then you have the Lord delivers Israel from service to Pharaoh, from the building of the store cities in 1:8 through the end of chapter 13. And so you've got five sections there. 1:8 through 2:25, Moses is delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. And then if you look to the first section of the second panel, you see Israel is delivered through water, driven into the wilderness, and brought to Mount Sinai. Section 2 of panel 1, the Lord appears to Moses on the mountain of God and consecrates him as his messenger to Israel. Section 2 of panel 2, the Lord appears to Israel on the mountain of God and consecrates Israel as his messenger to the nations. Section 3, you have in panel 1, you have the unraveling of Pharaoh's anti-creational agenda. Section 3 of panel 2, you have the unveiling of God's creation restoring agenda. Section 4 of panel 1, You have the Feast of Passover, and unleavened bread separates the people of God from the Egyptians. And then in section 4 of panel 2, you have the Feast of the Golden Calf separates those who are on the Lord's side from those who are not. And then in section 5 of panel 1, you have the Exodus is accomplished and the people are led by fire and cloud. And then in section 5 of the second panel, you have the tabernacle being constructed and the people of God are led by fire and cloud. So that reference to fire and cloud is sort of, you get to the end of the first panel, and you have the fire and the cloud, and then you have the exact same language used again at the end of the second panel. And in each of these sections within the panels, you often have the same language, and we'll see that tonight, will be used at the beginning of a section and the end of a section, and it sort of serves as bookends that help you know you found a division in the text, you found a section that was intended by the biblical author. And I think the panels are clearer than the sections. You could divide the sections into, say, 6 or 7 sections. I think they really should be seen as these 5 in each half that we have. But what is really clear is this pattern that what you see in the first panel in the life of Moses, you see one cycle, and then you see echoes of that cycle in the second panel again. The same story gets told over again. And so this thing that we're talking about in the Gospel of Matthew, where Jesus is following in the footsteps of Israel, this isn't just a New Testament, Old Testament thing. This is something we already see in the Old Testament stories, these sorts of echoes already. And so, having given a brief overview, where we covered up to, we did 8 lessons when we were in Exodus before, and we dealt with the introduction, giving this structure in more detail. We can't go into all the details tonight. And then we dealt with the prologue. We dealt with section 1, Moses delivered through water, driven into the wilderness and brought to Mount Sinai. And then we dealt with section 2, and we almost finished section 3. So we dealt with all of the plague, chapter 7 through 10, but we didn't get through chapter 11, and I was really bummed by that because I really wanted to finish out that section, but there just was not enough time before we had to move on to other things without keeping everyone here till like 8 or 8:30, which wouldn't have worked with generations. So I had to drop that. We're coming back into the very tail end of section 3, and then by God's grace, we'll get through all of section 4. So tonight, the goal is to get through chapter 11, and then chapter 12, verses 1 through 28. So about 38 verses. And so we'll have to buckle our seatbelts because there's a lot of material here. So chapter 11. And so open your Bibles to Exodus chapter 11. Exodus chapter 11 both gives the warning of the coming 10th blow. And also, as we will see, finishes out the section that began in chapter 7. And so the first 9 blows, the first 9 strikes against Egypt on the part of God, they're arranged into 3 sets of 3. So we talked about that before, that there's a pattern, that the first of each set of 3 has parallels, the second of each set of 3 has parallels, and the third of each set of 3 has parallels. So you have these 3 sets of 3, and then you have a 10th blow that is set apart from the first 3 sets of 3. And at the end of chapter 10, we find this. Pharaoh said unto him, that is to Moses, Moses and Pharaoh are talking after the end of that 9th blow, get thee from me, take heed to thyself, see my face no more, for in that day thou seest my face, thou shalt die. And Moses said, thou hast spoken well, I will see thy face again no more. And so the simplest way of understanding what's taking place in chapter 11 is that it runs continuously with the end of chapter 10. So Pharaoh has completely broken off all dialogue. I'm done talking to you, Moses. Get out of my face. If you come back here again, I'm going to kill you. That's what Pharaoh says. And Moses says, that's fine with me. Conversation is over. But before Moses actually leaves, he gets another revelation from God, and he gives that to Pharaoh. So he has one final message to Pharaoh while he's still there in the court of Pharaoh. And this is going to be Moses' last words to Pharaoh. This is the last time that Pharaoh will hear from God before God gets rid of Pharaoh once and for all. Pharaoh will speak to Moses one more time, but when Pharaoh speaks to Moses, he'll be saying, get out of my land, not get out of my face. He will be letting the people go, but Moses will not speak on that occasion. So the structure, though, of chapter 11 is almost like a sandwich. So you have God speaking to Moses in verses 1 through 3, and then in Verses 4 through 8, you have that final revelation of Moses through to Pharaoh. And then in 9 through 10, you have God speaking to Moses again. So there's no reason why verses 1 through 3 couldn't be God giving Moses a revelation even as he's there in Pharaoh's court. Quite possibly, that to me is the simplest way of there's been a lot of discussion about how to fit all of this together, but I think the simplest way of understanding it is Moses is there at the end of the discussion after the ninth plague, and God reveals verses 1 through 3 to Moses, and then God gives him one final message for Pharaoh. He gives that final message for Pharaoh, and then as they are leaving Pharaoh's court, they are given, Moses and Aaron are given another revelation from God. So let's work through the text. Verse 1, "And the Lord said unto Moses, Yet will I bring one plague or one blow more upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterwards, he will let you go hence. When he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out hence altogether." Now, as I mentioned previously, we really should not be thinking of 10 plagues because in modern English, we use the word plague to refer almost exclusively to an infectious disease. And only one of the 10 blows against Egypt can be described in that way. And the word that is translated as plague simply means a blow or a strike or a hit. It isn't necessarily an infectious disease, which makes sense because only one of the 10 blows is actually that. So it's a very general word that's just like God's hits against Egypt. And actually the English word plague used to have a general meaning. It could mean just a hit. So it's a perfectly appropriate translation 400 years ago, but we don't use the word plague in the same way that it used to be used. So it's not a mistranslation, but it's unfortunate that modern translations, with a few exceptions, haven't updated that because it sort of gives the wrong idea of what's going on. So there are these 10 blows against Egypt, and 9 have happened, and now there's going to be one more. "And when he shall let you go, he shall surely thrust you out hence altogether." God is saying to Moses, Pharaoh is not going to bargain with you this time. He's going to let you go, he's going to let all of you go, and he's going to let you go all of the way forever. When I'm done with this 10th blow, Pharaoh is going to be eager to see the backs of you and my people. And so he gives, with that as a basis, he gives Moses a command to speak to the people. "Speak now in the ears of the people," that is the people of Israel, "and let every man borrow of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor jewels of silver and jewels of gold." So throughout all the plagues episode, the last time that Moses has spoken to the people of Israel is back in chapter 6. He speaks to the people of Israel. They won't listen to him. And then we get the plague narrative, or the blows narrative. I keep calling them the plagues too because it's sort of a habit. That's how we hear them. Then we get the narrative of God dealing with Pharaoh. And now God is giving Moses, after he's demonstrated all of his signs in the land of Egypt, now God's giving Moses something else to say to his people. So he says to them, go and ask for gold and silver from your neighbors. And the King James margin has ask in place of borrow, which is what the Hebrew word normally means. And so I'm not really sure why they translated this as borrow, because they are not borrowing these things. They are asking for them, they're being given to them, and they are taking them away, and they are not bringing them back. So there's nothing in the word, you know, so there doesn't seem to be anything in the context that would require a translation of borrow. And borrowing is certainly not what is happening. So simply thinking of it as asking, they're going to ask and they're going to be given these treasures. They had been slaves. They had not been recompensed for their labors. And now God is going to supernaturally move the hearts of the Egyptians to gladly part with their stuff, to give back wages to the children of Israel. And they're going to give it to them. So verse 3, "And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people." So verse 3, verse 1 and 2 is a revelation that God gave to Moses even while he was there in Pharaoh's court. Verse 3 is a parenthesis that's giving some context for what's about to take place in verses 4 through 8. The point is that Pharaoh, by this point, is the only one who hasn't gotten it. So the children of Israel before hadn't believed Moses, and now the children of Israel are listening to Moses. The Egyptians had despised Moses, and now all the Egyptian people are paying attention and have great respect to Moses and to God. They have such respect for God that they are going to give their stuff away to the children of Israel just because they asked for it. So the situation has changed for everyone except for one man, Pharaoh. Pharaoh's servants respect Moses. Pharaoh's people respect Moses. But Pharaoh does not. His heart is hard. Pharaoh's the only one who didn't get it. And that is why Moses is going to be so angered by his continued obstinance. And Moses said, thus saith the Lord. So this is verse 4. What follows is a warning, but there is no offer of escape. Pharaoh had already said discussion was at an end. He has had his last chance, and now he is simply being told, this is what's going to happen to you and your people, Pharaoh. About midnight will I go out into the midst of Egypt. Now, in the previous 9 plagues, there had been involvement from Moses or Aaron. They had done something. They had raised a staff. They had spoken words. They had done symbolic actions that had happened at the beginning of these 9 blows. But at this 10th final blow, there's no human involvement at all from Moses or Aaron. It's a direct act of God. About midnight will I go out into the land, to the midst of Egypt. Verse 5, and all the firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die. From the firstborn of Pharaoh that sitteth upon his throne, even unto the firstborn of the maidservant that is behind the mill, and all the firstborn of beasts. There's 2 points on this verse I want to bring out. One is that decisions of federal heads have consequences for those under them. The decisions of a nation's leaders have consequences for the people who live in that nation. If you are a head of household, if you're a father, your decisions, your choices have consequences for those who are under your care, for your wife and children. And if you choose to rebel against God, the judgment of God is not going to fall only on you. It's going to fall on your household, and innocent people are going to suffer because of your sinful choices. If you've been entrusted with responsibility, your sin and your failure to live up to that responsibility can cause suffering for others. So that's 1 point. At the same time, though, we were already told earlier on that the Egyptians, not just Pharaoh, but the Egyptian people were participants in the oppression of the Israelites. They benefited, not just Pharaoh himself, but the Egyptian nation benefited from the enslavement of the Jewish people. And they hadn't protested, they hadn't complained, they hadn't done anything to stop Pharaoh's nefarious plan, they hadn't spoken out against it. And even though now they see who God is, they've already set events in motion, and they're going to suffer the consequences for that. Their judgment of God is coming. It also speaks about the firstborn of beasts. So it's not only that the Egyptians are going to be punished, all of them, because of Pharaoh's continued obstinacy, and of course they're not innocents, they are being punished for their own sin. But the reason the punishment is inexorable is because of Pharaoh's obstinance. So there's both a greater response, there's a responsibility for all of us for the decisions that we make, but there is a greater responsibility that we bear. If God has placed us over others, then we can cause them to suffer by failing to live up to that responsibility. But that isn't just true of humans and other humans. That's also true of humans and the natural order. As human beings, we've been called to steward nature, not to exploit nature. The mission God gave to Adam to represent his righteous rule over creation didn't disappear because of his rebellion, although it did become much harder. And the creation itself is groaning in travail because of our human rebellion. But we need to consider, I think one of the things that we need to think about is modern day environmentalism, at least at the surface level and at the deep level in many cases, has many things that are incompatible with Christianity, where there's a worship of Mother Nature or there's a devotion to, say, Marxist power politics, where they're not even really concerned about the environment, but they're just doing whatever it takes to create division and disunity. So we see those things, and sometimes our response can be, well, we don't like what environmentalists are doing, so we're going to be anti-environmentalist. And this can get pretty extreme. I had a professor at the first Bible college I went to who thought it was funny to say nuke the whales, baby, because he didn't like environmentalists. So he's like, well, just, you know, nuke the whales and other such like things. That kind of spirit isn't what we are called to. We are called to steward the natural order. We are called to care well for the natural order. And sometimes when there's a surface, like as much of the environmental movement has a lot of deeply problematic things, but sometimes we can look and we can say, these people, what they're saying are problematic, and we don't like what they're saying, and they're criticizing us, we don't like them, and we can reject that so strongly that we end up advocating for things that have an even deeper incompatibility with our Christian faith. So the Tower of Babel is not a Christian institution just because they stamp the bricks with "we like Christians" on them. And there is a lot about our modern order, our technological society that is being constructed that exploits and exploits and exploits everything about the world with no end and no limits and no boundaries, that is deeply incompatible with the kind of stewardship that we're called to exercise over creation. And creation is suffering as a result of the way that we have not cared for it well. And so we shouldn't allow an unbiblical environmentalism to distract us or keep us from seeing the fact that we are responsible for how we care for the natural order. And if we do so in a sinful and ungodly way, then the natural order is going to suffer as a result of our sin, and the judgment of God is going to affect not only us, but the creation that we were supposed to care for, even as it did for the Egyptians. Does that make sense what I'm getting at? Any questions on that before we move on? I see a hand. Okay. Any questions on that before we move on? What are some other unbiblical positions we could hold in regard to the environment or other issues because we don't like the secondary agendas of those who happen to be promoting them in our culture? So what I'm getting at is, what are some things? There's people who have agendas and they say something, and because of who's saying it, we want to say the opposite. And so we end up forcing ourselves into an unbiblical box because we don't like whoever happens to be advocating for a particular position in our society. Abby? There's a mic coming.
This is probably a deep question that maybe is debatable or something. But I guess there's the question of if the world is just getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, and then it's just going to be destroyed. Or it's that it gets worse and then it gets better and then it gets worse and then it gets better. Does that make sense? Because I think that sometimes I get caught in this the world's going anyway, so just let it go. Does that make sense? And then there's in that, there can be that heart problem of going, well, it's going, so just let it go. And what's the point? You know, kind of thing. Or is it more that the world has had times of... Because, the whole global warming thing and then everything they're trying to convince us of because of what we're doing, the world is going to fall apart. And it's has the world been worse than it is now, maybe at one point before? And maybe...
Well, Genesis 6, the world was about as bad as it's... Yeah. There's a couple aspects to your question. One is a technical question about the cycles of global heat and not... that I think is not something I feel competent to get into, at least in this setting. I don't have any particular expertise on that.
Okay.
There's a second, so that's one question. I'm going to set that one to the side. Okay. There's another question about, we can have this catastrophic attitude that we feel like the world is as bad as it's ever been. It's all going to fall apart. So why does anything that we do even matter? Mm-hmm. And that sort of question. And why does anything that we do for the environment matter? Why does anything we do for the gospel matter? Why does anything matter besides persuading a few people to join us in the lifeboat? And so it can basically be a lifeboat mentality that the only thing that matters is getting more professions of faith. And everything else can just go in a handbasket because that's where it's going anyways. Mm-hmm. And I think that question, that is something the scriptures answer clearly.
Yes.
And that is that, this world was created to be our home. And this world is, so this world system, so there's a song, "This world is not my home, I'm just a passing through." Well, if we're talking about this present world order, that's true. And that is one way that the phrase "the world" can be used. But if we're talking about creation, we were created to rule over creation, and the end is not that God is going to destroy the earth and start over again. If that was his plan, he could have done that a long time ago. Mm-hmm. No, his plan is that he's going to restore creation. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a radical renewal of creation. And we don't know when that's going to take place. And we do see that there have been cycles. There have been times in human history, both in the flood and even after the flood, where things have been very dark. And then light has dawned and things have improved. So we don't know what the future holds. Right. But what we do know is that faithful labor for the sake of faithful labor for the sake of the Lord won't be in vain.
Amen.
And so though we don't know how our labor is going to pay out, we do know that in some way that we can't understand, that is mysterious to us, the labor that we put forth, whether to build a family, to build a church, to make the world a better place, as it were, across the board, when we do that in submission, keeping the gospel as the primary thing, that labor isn't in vain, and that labor is used by God in his sovereignty to bring about the new Jerusalem that will make everything new. Mm-hmm. So the second, so sort of the second question of the three questions that were in your one question, the second question is, we ought to be fundamentally hopeful people. We ought to be real about what's going on and adapt ourselves where we need to, but we should be fundamentally hopeful people that are realizing that what we do matters and what we do can make a difference, and what we do in the providence of God could make a far bigger difference than we realize. So since we don't know what's at stake, since we don't know what the future holds, we are called to faithfulness and we should be committed to that. And the third question is, I think, you know, things like global warming, it's easy to get caught up in the politics of how things are being used for political purposes. And it's easy to get caught up in the scientific debates of some of the, you know, technicalities of the cycles of global heat and cooling down. But setting that aside, even entirely apart from that, pollution is bad for humans across the board, regardless of the debates about global warming. If you look at the cities of India and the smog that is there, if you look at some of the smog that's been taken away from American cities, polluting the environment is bad for humans right now, entirely irrespective of any predictions about what bad it may cause in the future. And so at the same time, we should be aware of the radical political agendas that get pushed in the name of global warming or whatnot. And we should be, I'm very skeptical of people who claim to know what's going to happen in the future, apart from the coming of the city of God. I'm very, very in on that and very skeptical of all other future predictions. But at the same time, we shouldn't be so obsessed with the political, you know, baggage that's coming along. We should be aware of that, but we should care about not polluting the environment, because it's just bad for us right now. And that was kind of even some of what I was getting at before, that we can be so like, there's this is being used, and often we're right about that. This is being used for bad political ends, and we should stand against that. But we shouldn't be so tied up by that that we don't say, okay, you know, is, you know, creating smog in the atmosphere really a good thing for human beings? No, it's not. Right. So, you know, let's do what we can.
And it's kind of like where Adam and Eve, you know, they were told to take care of what God had given them on earth and to do, I can't quote.
Yeah, so our attitude should be one of stewarding what's been given rather than exploiting it without limits.
Right, and even when they sinned and they kind of ruined it all, they still went forward and did what the Lord called them to do. And it can be discouraging, I think, in our sin and when we're watching the world crumbling around us, to not want to continue that calling that God did in the OG in the very beginning.
Yeah.
And then also as Christians, we should look that Christ and God is going to redeem the world. So
yep,
we
exactly.
need to have that attitude. Okay, thank you.
Was
so
there
much.
Someone else who had their hand up at that point? All right, we'll go ahead and move on. Verse 6, and there shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there was none like it, nor shall be like it anymore. So the last time in Exodus that we heard about a cry was in chapter 3. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people which are in Egypt, and have heard their cry by reason of their taskmasters, or before or in front of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. The taskmasters heard the cry of the oppressed people of God, and they did nothing. The Egyptian people heard the cry, and they did nothing. And now they and those they are responsible for are going to receive the suffering they have dealt to others. The perversions of justice that are trumpeted in our society should not blind us to the fact that God loves justice and he loves to bring the unjust to account. And this is one of the things that I've been getting at over and over again, is the fact that language of justice and language of care for the environment, all of these things are manipulated to evil ends in our society. Yes. Does that mean we can abandon the things themselves? No. We must be people who love the world that God has made, and people who love justice and seek justice and seek the good of the world and the good of those in it, even as we stand against the lies of those who use those good things for their own nefarious purposes. So and there's more there, but we have to hasten on. Verse 7, but against any of the children of Israel shall not a dog move his tongue against man or beast. So just as God is going to judge the natural environment and the beasts of the Egyptians, God is going to give blessing to the beast of the children of Israel. They are not going to die. You may know that the Lord doth put a difference between the Egyptians and Israel. As we'll see, the difference that the Lord put was the difference of atonement without which the firstborn of Israel would have died too. God's grace is free, but his forgiveness is never arbitrary. God's forgiveness is based on atonement. And our forgiveness isn't based on our own good-heartedness, that we're just better or bigger-hearted people. Our forgiveness is based on the forgiveness that we have received and the atonement that Christ has accomplished for us. We can forgive because we've been forgiven. Verse 8, and all these thy servants shall come down unto me and bow down themselves unto me, saying, get thee out, and all the people that follow thee, and after that I will go out. And it's a little ambiguous, some of the grammar, some different people have some different views here, but it seems simplest to say that God is saying, your servants are going to bow down to me, because there's no record of the Egyptians bowing down to Moses. But this is God's speech that Moses is giving to Pharaoh. And God is saying, your servants are going to bow down to me, and I'm going to go up out of the land of Egypt. And of course, God appears in a pillar of fire, and he goes up out of the land of Egypt at the head of the column of the children of Israel. So that seems to make the most sense of this verse. And he went out from Pharaoh. So now that's the end of Moses' speech to Pharaoh that God has given him. God has given him these words, speak to Pharaoh. Moses finishes that. And then we have this final comment. And he went out from Pharaoh in a great anger. Moses' anger against Pharaoh was a result of his compassion for the Egyptians. I mentioned it earlier that sometimes it's appropriate to be angry. And Moses was angry because God was willing to have mercy on the Egyptians, and yet Pharaoh was so stubborn that he would not relent. And because of that, people who were under Pharaoh's care were going to die. And that rightly made Moses upset. But our anger should be driven not by insults to ourselves, but by compassion for others. And that appears to certainly to be the case for Moses, who cared even for the Egyptians who had been oppressing his people enough to be upset at the judgment that Pharaoh's stubbornness was going to bring upon them. Verse 9, and the Lord said unto Moses, Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you, that my wonders or my signs may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. And Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart so that he would not let the children of Israel go out of his land. So as translated here, this is puzzling. Pharaoh shall not hearken unto you because the signs have already been multiplied. Mapping English tense onto Hebrew and Greek tense forms is sometimes quite tricky, and I'll skip the details. But it seems best to, as one translator renders it, one commentator renders it, and the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh has not paid heed to you in order that my signs would be multiplied in Egypt. So there's more that could be said, but we'll pass on through that. So this is a concluding summary of the third section of the first panel. So the third section goes from chapter 7 to chapter 11. It's God's unraveling of Pharaoh's anti-creational agenda. And now we have a summary at the end. And God is saying to Moses, Pharaoh has not listened to you. And now as a result of that, I've done all of these wonders that have been multiplied in the land of Egypt. And he has hardened his heart. And now there's going to be another section that's going to deal with the Passover. And then, so you have the first nine signs and the warning of the 10th sign, the warning of the 10th blow. Then you have the institution of Passover. Then you have the 10th blow itself. Now, does that remind anyone of anything, that pattern? We have all these signs that don't lead to belief, that don't lead to any fundamental change in the situation. Then you have a shared meal, and then you have a final sign that fundamentally transforms everything. Does that remind any of you of anything? Who's? Something specific, one of the Gospels in particular, though. John. So remember, we did John's Gospel, that's right. So in John's Gospel, there are seven signs. And we won't go into all the arguments for this, but the seventh sign is the resurrection of Christ. So at the beginning, you have the warning, destroy this temple, in 3 days I'll raise it up. That's the promise of the resurrection. So you have an announcement of the resurrection, and you have seven things, and only seven things, in the Gospel of John that are described using the language of sign. There are seven signs in John's Gospel, and the seventh is announced early on, and it is fulfilled in the resurrection of Christ. That's the final sign. That's the sign that transforms everything and ultimately redeems God's people, the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And so, in the first half, John chapter 1 through John chapter 12, you have six signs. The first six signs, and the promise of the seventh sign, and then what happens in John chapter 13 through 18, or 13 through 17? What do we have? The supper. They eat a meal, they share a meal together. And then you have the fulfillment of the seventh sign. So you have first signs and promise, you have a meal instituted, and then you have the seventh sign. So this is something that I did a whole series on the structure of the signs in John's gospel. And there's a lot of connections between the signs that John highlights in his gospel and the signs of the book of Exodus. So what's the first of John's signs in the gospel of John in chapter 2? Wedding of Cana, where water is turned into something red. And the first sign in the book of Exodus is water is changed into something that is red, something different. We won't go into the details of that. What's the last sign in Exodus? What's the final sign? It's the death of the firstborn. What's the last sign in the book of John? Death, burial, resurrection of the firstborn. So there are a lot of connections. One of the other things is the word that's translated in Greek, the word that's translated as wonder here in Exodus chapter 12 or Exodus chapter 11 is semeia. That's the same word that's consistently used for the seven signs in John's gospel. So the Greek word is the same. If you look at the Greek Old Testament that the Apostle John would have had access to, he deliberately picks the same word that the book of Exodus in Greek that John would have had access to uses. And so there are a lot of different connections, but at the end of John chapter 12, you have this. But though he had done so many miracles or so many signs before them, yet they believed not on him. So you have the first set of signs, and then you have a declaration, I did all these signs, they didn't believe. And then you have the final sign, the climactic triumph of Christ. And you have that same exact pattern in Exodus. And you have the same pattern of signs, Passover, Exodus. In John's gospel, you have signs, supper, Exodus. And John, more than any of the other gospels, hammers home, we're going to see this over and over again, he hammers home the connection between Jesus and the Passover lamb. So now we come to the fourth section of the first panel, the Feast of the Passover, and unleavened bread separates the people of God from the Egyptians. So there's a major section break at 12:28. And this section, verses 1 through 28, clearly splits into two parallel speeches, each of which splits into two parts. So we have the speech of God to Moses and Aaron in verses 1 through 20, and then a shorter speech of Moses to the elders of Israel in 21 through 28, and each of these speeches split into two portions. So the first portion of the first speech is instructions for the present observance of the Passover in verses 1 through 13 of chapter 12. And the Lord spake unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months, it shall be the first month of the year to you. All the other foundational laws were given at Mount Sinai. There was something, though, unique about the Passover. The Passover was given as a deliverance in the land of Egypt. And the deliverance that Christ brings to us comes to us while we are still in Egypt. God comes to us and he gives us his redemption. And then we come to Sinai, as it were, and receive all the other instructions that he has for us. So there's something significant there. And God tells Moses that this Passover is going to be the beginning of months for you. So without sorting out all the complicated status of the multiple Hebrew calendars and the many debates about how they sort out, the point, though, is clear. The children of Israel were to order their time by what God had done for them. Their lives were to be governed by the rhythms of redemption. And that's something we have to fight for, because if we don't fight for it, our lives will be ordered by the rhythms of the secular world around us. And even in church, the pattern tends to be that churches will order their calendars not by the pattern of redemption, not even by the traditional Christian holidays, but by what takes place in the secular world and the holidays that the secular world has instituted, rather than the holidays that we may find in Scripture, or the patterns of weekly rest and worship that we find in the Scriptures. So we need to fight against allowing our lives to be structured by the rhythms of the world and push for having them structured by the rhythms of redemption. Verse 3, speak ye unto all the congregation of Israel, saying, in the 10th day of this month they shall take to them every man a lamb, according to the house of their fathers, a lamb for a house. And if the household be too little for the lamb, let him and his neighbor next unto his house take it according to the number of the souls. Every man according to his eating shall make your count for the lamb. So the eating is a crucial part of the Passover, and this emphasizes that. It wasn't just a ritual that needed to be performed by them for others. It was something they needed to participate in. Verse 5, your lamb shall be without blemish, a male of the first year. Ye shall take it from the sheep or from the goats. So when we use the English word lamb, we think of a sheep. But the Hebrew word that's translated as lamb refers to a small flock animal that could be either a sheep or a goat. So the way that sort of Hebrew breaks down its words for animals is a little different than what English does. And so your lamb is a small flock animal, and it could be a sheep or it could be a goat. Verse 6, and ye shall keep it up until the 14th day of the same month. And the whole assembly of the congregation of Israel shall kill it in the evening. So they were to take on the 10th. So verse 3, speaking unto the congregation of Israel, in the 10th day of the month, they were to take an animal. So they were to select the lamb, whether it was a sheep or a goat, on the 10th day, and then they were to keep it for 4 days. Now, the text doesn't tell us exactly why they were to keep the animal for 4 days. But there is something that's very interesting that's going on here with this sacrifice. So in chapter 8, remember, Pharaoh says to Moses, go tell the people to sacrifice in the land. What did Moses say? Well, he said they couldn't sacrifice in the land because of what? The people were... they were afraid of the Egyptians because they said, we're going to sacrifice the abomination of the Egyptians. The Egyptians are going to stone us. We can't sacrifice in the land. So they were afraid of the Egyptians. They had been oppressed by the Egyptians, and now they were afraid of them, and they were unwilling to worship God in the land. This breaks that cycle. The children of Israel are going to sacrifice to God in the land, Egyptians or no Egyptians. They got over the fear of sacrificing to God, and perhaps the 4-day hold on the lamb had something to do with that. Sometimes the barriers to freedom have as much to do with the strength of our own fears as with the power of our enemies. And those who are oppressed, and this is something in response to so much of what goes on in our culture, those who are oppressed are not epistemically privileged. Being oppressed does not give you a stranglehold on the truth. In fact, if you have been oppressed, if you have been deprived, you are epistemically, that is, that refers to how you perceive the world. Your ability to correctly understand the world is not helped by being oppressed. It is hindered by being oppressed. And so that is what it means to be oppressed, is to be deprived of something that's good for you. And so those who have been oppressed by others are experts, as it were, on how they feel and what they are suffering, and they should be gently listened to, but they are not experts on what they need. If they've really been oppressed, they've been deprived, and hence they need others to rescue them. And that is one of the key things, that is one of the great lies of the social justice literature of our day, is that if you've been oppressed, you have a stranglehold on the truth that everyone has to learn from you what you need. But if you've really been harmed, your ability to perceive what you need has been one of the first things to be harmed, and you need others wiser and stronger than you to come rescue you from what has been done to you. And if you don't want to be rescued, you cannot be helped, because help involves rescue. It involves gentle listening. It involves compassion. It involves sympathy and listening to what people have gone through and tender compassion for how that has affected them. But it ultimately involves someone coming and rescuing them. And if you don't want to be rescued, you can't be helped. And telling people that those who are seeking to rescue them are the problem and not the solution is exacerbating and intensifying the oppression that people face. And it is evil, and God hates it. Verse 7. They shall take of the blood and strike it on the two side posts and on the upper doorpost of the houses wherein they shall eat it. And there's some symbolism here. Excavations in Egypt have revealed that aristocrats in Egypt would paint in bright colors on the doorpost who the house belonged to. And so they are now going to put blood on the doors of their houses, and that's going to reveal these houses belong to God, and the people in them belong to God. There's another connection here that we'll get to in the second speech. Verse 8, they shall eat the flesh in that night, roast with fire and unleavened bread, and bitter herbs they shall eat it, the bitter herbs which remind them of the bitter bondage they have been under. Verse 14 of chapter 1, they made their lives bitter. The Egyptian taskmasters made the lives of the slaves bitter with hard bondage, and these bitter herbs were to remind them. Once again, there's emphasis placed on the active participation of the children of Israel in this supper. The eating and even the manner of their eating was crucial. In many ways, participation in the Passover marked the boundary lines of the people of God, and this is also true of the supper in the church, as we'll see in a moment. Verse 9, eat not of it raw nor sodden at all with water, but roast with fire his head with his legs and with the pertinence thereof. And ye shall let nothing of it remain until the morning, and that which remaineth of it until the morning ye shall burn with fire. Now, there's a number of connections throughout the Passover ritual that connect it to the consecration of the priest. So when the priests are consecrated, this is talked about in Exodus, it's talked about in Numbers and Leviticus. One of the things is they would go into the tabernacle and they would offer the feast of dedication, and then if aught of the flesh of the consecrations or of the bread remaineth to the morning, then thou shalt burn the remainder with fire, it shall not be eaten. So this idea that they would eat it that night and whatever was left over was to be burnt is a connection between the consecration of the people of Israel as the people of God and the consecration of the priests later on. So the idea that God is forming a nation of priests is very central to the details of the Passover ritual. Verse 11. And thus shall ye eat it, with your loins girded, your shoes on your feet, and your staff in your hand, and ye shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. For I'll pass through the land of Egypt this night, and will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both man and beast. And against all the gods of Egypt I will execute judgment. I am the Lord. And the blood shall be to you for a token upon the houses where you are. That is a sign. It shall be a sign upon the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be upon you to destroy you when I smite the land of Egypt. Obviously, there's so much here. There's so many things we can comment on. But one thing I wanted to make mention is he says, against all the gods of Egypt, I will execute judgment. That is said only of this 10th blow. So there's one way of looking at the blows against Egypt as though each blow connects to a particular Egyptian god. And so you can create a chart that makes that look pretty good. People have even written books about it. But the deeper you dig into how Egyptian religion actually works, the weaker that case appears. I don't think we should connect the blows primarily to the Egyptian gods. It's primarily the undoing of creation. So the connections are primarily to Genesis 1, not to the gods and goddesses that the Egyptian worshipped. At the same time, the defeat of Egypt was the defeat of Egypt's gods. And that is clear, and that is particularly the case with the death of the firstborn. And so now we come to instructions for future celebration of the Passover in verses 14 through 20. So having given instructions for the present observance of the Passover, God now turns to giving instructions for its future celebration, highlighting in particular the role of unleavened bread and the symbolic removal of leaven from the houses and lives of the people of Israel. Verse 14, and this day shall be unto you for a memorial. And you shall keep it a feast to the Lord throughout your generations. You shall keep it a feast by an ordinance forever. 7 days shall ye eat unleavened bread. Even the first day ye shall put away leaven out of your houses. For whosoever eateth leavened bread from the first day unto the seventh day, that soul shall be cut off from Israel. Where does this get picked up on in the New Testament? Does anyone remember? There's a passage that specifically speaks about purging leaven out of the midst of the people of God. Ron? Oh, well, that would be one reference, but there's a passage that builds on this in Paul's letters. Do you know what letter it's in? Anyone? 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Purge out therefore the old leaven, that ye may be a new lump as ye are unleavened. For even Christ our Passover is sacrificed for us. Therefore let us keep the feast, not with old leaven, neither with the leaven of malice and wickedness, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. So in the context of 1 Corinthians 5, Paul is talking about church discipline. And he says, if you have an unrepentant sinner in your midst, it's like leaven. And you can't keep the feast of God with that kind of leaven in your midst. Get it out of the church, or rather get him out of the church. And this teaching on the removal of leaven as we celebrate the feast of the Passover is the Old Testament basis on which Paul builds his teaching about church discipline, that the presence of those who are living in unrepentant sin affects our ability to offer appropriate worship to God. And that's why those who refuse to repent of their sin must be removed from the table of the Lord, lest the table become our table and not the Lord's table. Being removed from the table of the Lord is not a light thing. In fact, it's a judgment we ought to fear more than death, because as the followers of Jesus, we don't need to fear death, but we ought to fear removal from the congregation of the Lord. And so it's something that we ought to take very, very seriously. Verse 16, and in the first day there shall be a holy convocation or assembly. In the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation or assembly to you. No manner of work shall be done in them, save that which every man must eat. That only must be may be done of you, and ye shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For in the selfsame day have I brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Therefore shall ye observe this day in your generations by an ordinance forever. In the first month, in the 14th day of the month at even, ye shall eat unleavened bread until the one in the 20th day of the month at even. 7 days shall there be no leaven found in your houses. For whosoever eateth that which is leavened, even that soul shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he be a stranger or born in the land. Ye shall eat nothing leavened in all your habitations, shall ye eat unleavened bread. And so Paul mentioned in 1 Corinthians 6 that Christ is our Passover. Christ is the Passover lamb whose blood is applied to the doorpost of our lives that delivers us from the wrath of God. So our salvation comes from a living and vital union with Christ. Salvation places us into the true vine. Our salvation comes not from eating the Lord's Supper or passing through the waters of baptism, but rather from the transforming work of the Spirit. In the same way, the children of Israel were actually delivered by the grace of God, not by some magic ritual that they performed. Yet though they were not saved because of what they did, they were not saved apart from participation in the Passover meal either. Though the Passover meal was not a magical talisman, it was more than a mere symbol. It was itself a living participation in the reality that it symbolized. And the same is true of baptism and the Lord's Supper in the Christian church. They do not point to a reality that is distant from them. They are instead one of the means that we participate in the reality toward which they point. And so, with a little fear and trepidation to help make sense of how this works, there is a strong analogy to the relationship of marriage. So the three things that Christ has ordained in the world are marriage, human government, and the church. And each of those have an ordinance that functions to hold them together. So the ordinance of marriage is that of a sexual relationship between a husband and a wife. It isn't just a symbol of something other than the marriage. It is one of the means by which the marriage is held together. Now, you're not married only. The marriage bed is not, you're not only when you're in the marriage bed are you married, and other times you're not married. That isn't even how you become married. But it is more than just a symbol that points to something other. It's not just a bare symbol. It is how you participate in a deep and a real sense in the marriage itself. The state is given the power of the sword. The state is constituted by its authority to exercise judgment. So a state that does not execute vengeance against the ungodly is failing as a state, because it's the right to execute vengeance against the ungodly that makes the state the state. And so a state that never acts on that doesn't have what it takes to hold itself together. And we're seeing, as we have a breakdown in criminal justice, we have a breakdown in the state, because that is what God has given the state to define the state. And as the state participates in that, it becomes an actual functioning government. And the same thing is true of baptism and the Lord's Supper. It is something that we participate in that is not just it's not a magical act that somehow if we take part of the supper, then we're going to be saved by that. That's not the way it works at all. Any more than the Passover was a magical act that they could save themselves by a sacrifice. No, they were saved by the grace of God, and we're saved by the grace of God. But at the same time, there is a real participation in a union with Christ as we take part in the ordinance that he has given us. There's a reality that we commune with, and Paul makes it very clear that when you commune at the table of the Lord, you have real communion with God and his people, and when you commune at the table of the demons, you have communion with them, and therefore you can't have communion with both. It's not just a signboard, it is a living reality that we participate in. And of course, there's a lot more that could be said about that, but we'll have to hasten on. Having now finished the Lord's speech to Moses, we're given the speech of Moses to the elders of Israel. Verse 21, then Moses called for all the elders of Israel and said unto them, and it's implied that Moses has already given the instructions that we found in verses 1 through 20. Draw out and take you a lamb according to your families and kill the Passover, and ye shall take a bunch of hyssop. So there's a connection here to the crucifixion, preserved only in the Gospel of John, who emphasizes so much of the Passover symbolism. After this, Jesus, knowing that all things were now accomplished, that the scripture might be fulfilled, saith, I thirst. Now there was set a vessel full of vinegar, and they filled a sponge with vinegar and put it upon hyssop and put it in his mouth. So there was hyssop that was used for the Passover ritual, and there was hyssop that was used for Christ as he was sacrificed on the cross. And dip it in the blood that is in the basin, and strike the lintel and the two side posts with the blood that is in the basin. How many of you remember the puzzling story in Exodus 4 in which Zipporah circumcised the son of Moses? That strange, strange story about the bloody bridegroom or something like that. So we don't have time to sort through all the details. But basically, as we worked through those details a long time ago, what happens is Moses has failed to circumcise his son. And because Moses has failed to circumcise his son is about to experience the judgment of God. And so Zipporah circumcises her son and takes the bloody foreskin and touches the feet, not of Moses, but of her son. So she strikes the feet of the son in a symbolic action to indicate that the circumcision has been done. Now, in the first panel of the book of Exodus, the word that is used to refer to Zipporah's action is only used two times. Once is where blood is applied to the feet of Moses' son to indicate that he will not be destroyed by the Lord for failing to participate in the covenantal sign. And the second time is when blood is applied to the door of the households of all of Israel so that they will be spared the judgment of God. In both passages, there is a promise of vengeance against Pharaoh's firstborn son. So you're holding my son in bondage, I'm going to judge your firstborn son. But in order for Moses to escape the judgment that he was predicting, his son had to be circumcised, the blood had to be applied. And the same thing is true. What was true of Moses as an individual and his family was true of the nation of Israel. It's not an accident that that word is used in the first panel only those two times. The connection is deliberate. Where are we? And none of you shall go out at the door of his house until the morning. And once again, I mentioned that there's a lot of parallels between the consecration of the priests and the Levites and the children of Israel. So that was another thing. When the sons of Aaron were consecrated as priests, they were to remain in the tabernacle enclosure. They were not to leave. The same thing is true as the children of Israel as a whole are being dedicated as priests unto the Lord. Verse 23, for the Lord will pass through to smite the Egyptians, and when he seeth the blood upon the lintel and on the two side posts, the Lord will pass over the door and will not suffer the destroyer to come in unto your houses to smite you. All of us deserve judgment, and we are saved only through the death of another. Verse 24, and ye shall observe this thing for an ordinance to thee and to thy sons forever. And it shall come to pass that when ye be come to the land which the Lord will give you, according as he hath promised, that ye shall keep this service. The word that's translated as service is the very same word that was used for their slavery to Pharaoh. The problem with the Egyptian bondage wasn't that they had to serve. The problem was that they were serving the wrong master. Worship is a service that we render to God. That's why we call it a Sunday morning worship service. And while we worship God in all that we do, God's people in every age have been commanded to engage in gathered and organized worship of God. That's what we were created for. That's what orders the world. Worship is the goal, the purpose of humanity. That's what we were created for. That's worth dying for. That's what we're here for. And sometimes, and it was even in the slideshow this morning, we can contrast, and certainly I would agree that we don't want a dead religion where it's just a ritual that we go through. So you can have a religion versus a relationship. But that's not a dichotomy that you actually find in Scripture. It's certainly one you can see out there in the world. But just as you don't want a religious ritual without a relationship, you also can't have a relationship without religion. God desires and demands ordered worship of God, which is what religion is not a bad thing. It is a necessary thing. The worship of God is about more than the emotional connection that we feel or don't feel to God in our worship. It's not something just a quick fix for us so that we feel a certain way about God. It's about what God deserves. It's about the worship that he demands. But the hour cometh and now is when the true worshipers shall worship the Father in spirit and in truth, for the Father seeketh such to worship him. God is a spirit, and they that worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. And if you look at the depictions of worship in Revelation, you will find that this is what they are focused on. They are focused on God getting the worship that he deserves. That's why we gather. And that's what the goal of creation is. Thou art worthy, O Lord, to receive glory and honor and power, for thou hast created all things, and for thy pleasure they are and were created. And while we certainly should never engage in dead religious ritual in which our hearts are not engaged, the primary criteria of true worship is not whether we find pleasure in it, but whether God finds pleasure in it. And we can only evaluate that, not by looking inside and evaluating our emotions, but by looking to the Word of God and evaluating the adequacy of what we're doing according to God's Word. Verse 26, and it shall come to pass when your children shall say unto you, what mean ye by this service? That ye shall say, it is the sacrifice of the Lord's Passover, who passed over the houses of the children of Israel in Egypt when he smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses, and the people bowed the head and worshipped. We should involve our children in our worship, but we should involve them as children who need to learn. They're not adults yet. They need to be taught. Verse 28, and the children of Israel went away and did as the Lord had commanded Moses and Aaron. So did they. The repetition of the reference to the command to Moses. So we had a command to Moses and to Aaron. Moses and Aaron tell the children of Israel this at the beginning. And then at the end of this section, we have a repetition of that command that just as God had commanded them, so did they. The last time Moses spoke to the children of Israel, they did not listen. Moses spoke so to the children of Israel, but they did not listen to Moses for anguish of spirit and for cruel bondage. And so now that God has brought 9 blows against the Egyptians, now God's own people are paying attention. And now God's going to bring a final blow that is going to cause the Egyptians to act as well. We are now out of time and past time, and we are done, and you are dismissed to go get your children.
Thank you for listening to this message. If you would like to learn more about the Westside Baptist Church, please visit our website, www.BibleDirectionForLife.com. Subscribe to the podcast if you would like to hear new sermons and lessons each week. And remember that a sermon podcast is no substitute for picking up a Bible and reading it for yourself.